Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It is Tuesday, July 2nd. Some worry a recent ruling by the U.S. Supreme Court weakens current federal anti-bribery laws and the responsibility will fall on the states and counties. We explore more about what the ruling means. Hawaiian Electric Company this week put in place its public safety shutoff program, a program of last resort to hopefully prevent another wildfire disaster. Residents in areas at high risk for fires sound off. And not all avocados are created equal. The quest to tell them apart leads us to a USDA researcher in Hilo. And wartime Honolulu through the eyes of a child, a new exhibit on the USS Battleship Missouri, highlights that point in time. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Honolulu Mayor Rick Blangiardi signed a bill into law that tightens up the city's gift laws. Previously, city workers could accept gifts of up to $200 in a year, but now that is lowered to $50. It comes after the indictments of city workers with the Department of Planning and Permitting dating to 2021. The mayor hopes to improve perception about public corruption.
Being this is my first time in elected office, I will tell you, I cringe every time I hear people talk about corrupt politicians. It seems to we live in a world and an age now where that kind of labeling, that kind of name-calling, and the stories that are done are just really painful, knowing full well you have the responsibility, not only as an elected official, but the incredible privilege to be responsible for the city and county of Honolulu. So anything that we can possibly do to assure the public out there, the people who work here are doing the right things for the right reasons for them, I want to be sure we can do that. So with the opportunity to sign this bill, hopefully we've taken a little bit of a bite out of that quick-to-label designation, if you will, of those people in elected office being corrupt. I would tell you I personally hate that.
That was Honolulu Mayor Rick Blangiardi talking about the need to toughen our ethics laws. We also hear from David Monk, the chair of the Honolulu Ethics Commission.
We don't necessarily, as commissioners, know all of the details. When somebody comes in and says, can I accept this or is this a conflict? The staff will tell them straight up whether it's a conflict or whether it's allowed under existing city law. And we really appreciate when they ask first rather than do something and then after the fact somebody complains and then we have to investigate. We prefer not to have that happen. So that's why we're spending a lot of time on education and training for the entire city staff and all elected and appointed officials. And it seems to be having an effect because we've had very, very few complaints in recent times about people doing things that they shouldn't.
The move to strengthen city laws comes as the U.S. Supreme Court issued a ruling last week that some say weakens federal bribery laws. The case is Snyder versus the U.S. and has to do with an Indiana mayor convicted of bribery. Retired federal public defender Ali Silver talks about the impact of the high court ruling against the backdrop of recent high-profile local public corruption cases.
So there are essentially, or there were, two bribery statutes under federal criminal law. One applies to the federal government, and it's the bribery statute itself. And then Congress, under Ronald Reagan, passed a second law that applied the federal bribery statute to state and local officials. And that's this statute, which is now in question, which is called the Dishonest Services Statute. It's the same statute in which Kaneshiro was recently charged under. And what the Supreme Court essentially did in interpreting this statute in this case was say that this is not a gratuity statute. It doesn't decriminalize gratuities. It only criminalizes bribery. And therefore, if a politician is simply given a gratuity, even if it's because they did some favorable action to a company, that is not a crime under federal law anymore. So essentially, unless you can prove a bribe was given, in other words, some gift or money up front to a public official in exchange for some action, some favorable action, then even if you give a gratuity later in the form of campaign contributions or anything else later, then that is not a crime under federal law. It may be in violation of state and local rules or laws, but it's not a crime under federal law. So essentially now you can meet with a politician, ask for some favorable legislation, walk away, and then give gifts and money and gratuities later in appreciation for what the politician did.
Yeah, I mahalo you.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's, so in this particular, I mean, I think it's important to understand what happened in this case because it really kind of tells you how the future is going to look. In that, in this case, a mayor gave two contracts to a trucking company. And as part of that contract, the mayor, through the city and county where the mayor was, bought five Peterbilt trucks for the company to use as part of the contract. Well, the next year, the company, Peterbilt, gave the mayor $13,000 in appreciation. And the mayor was charged with bribery under the Dishonest Services Statute under the guise that, you know, obviously he bought the trucks and now the company's giving him money, and that was a kind of a form of a bribe. And the Supreme Court said, no, unless you can prove that the act occurred either in conjunction with the giving of the trucks or before that, and that it was a clear bribe, the fact that the company gave a year later a gratuity in the form of $13,000 to the mayor, which is a lot of money, especially for a small town in Indiana, then that's no longer a federal crime. It may have, as the court said, violate state statutes, if there are any, prohibiting such donations, but it doesn't violate federal law. So you can imagine, if I'm a politician, that now I can meet with somebody, they can ask me for a favor, and I might even expect maybe something in the future, but it's not a crime under federal law anymore to accept a gratuity from that same contractor if they give me something later. And so many people have said that this decision absolutely guts the bribery statute under federal law and really is going to create some serious corruption issues for state and local officials in the future.
Yeah, I mean, some might feel this is very disheartening just because, you know, there was an effort to really clean up government with the public corruption cases that we saw with the police chief and his deputy prosecutor wife, Catherine Kealoha. And then, you know, with the arrests and the indictments that we saw, you know, with Keith Conoshiro and company. And then the two lawmakers, right, Kalani English and Ty Cullen, who served time for, you know, in their cases and are out.
Well, yeah, and this would also affect, you know, like the Liquor Commission cases and the zoning, the planning board members who were charged. Because what it's saying is you have to have clear evidence of a quid pro quo, of the bribery, in order for it to qualify as a bribery under the statute. If you don't have that clear and unambiguous evidence, then it's not a bribery, even if a gift was given. So, you know, all that evidence about Manapu is given and people giving, you know, small gifts to these small-time state and local planners and officials, well, that's okay because that's just giving, you know a gratuity. It's not a bribery, even though, you know, you've got to expect that if I'm working in one of those offices and I know I'm going to get free lunches and I'm going to get taken out for lunch or dinner, or I'm going to get some small cash amounts later on, to me, that's clearly a bribe because I'm expecting it. But this decision basically says the government's going to have to prove by clear and unambiguous evidence that it's a bribe, not a gratuity. And that's exactly the winning argument that was made in the Conoshiro Mitsunaga case, which was, this is a gratuity, that is not illegal under federal law, it was not a bribe, it was not a, there's no evidence of a clear and unambiguous quid pro quo of a bribery, therefore they can't be found guilty under the statute. So the argument made by the defense in the Conoshiro case basically dovetails with this Supreme Court decision. And in fact, the district court was well aware that the Supreme Court had heard argument on this case, and that had it had indicated that it was going to rule in this manner, which is why there was a jury instruction given in the Kaneshiro case that specifically said that unless the government can prove beyond a reasonable doubt by clear and unambiguous evidence that there was a bribe, you have to find them not guilty. And in the Kaneshiro-Mitsunaga case, I mean, there may have been a ton of circumstantial evidence. We all may have a gut feeling that we know what happened, but there was no clear and unambiguous evidence.
In the case of Cullen and English, there was clear evidence.
Right, because what this decision really means and what these jury instructions that are being given to juries mean is you have to have either a secret tape of the actual conversation where the bribe is clearly given, or you have to have a member of the bribe come forward, like happened in the Cullen and English case where Mr. Choi came forward and said, I gave the bribe. You're going to have that kind of evidence in order to convict a public official now of bribery. So all around this new interpretation of the statute and the way the courts are being instructed to interpret it, it's going to make it very, very difficult to convict public officials now of bribery.
So prosecutors need to make sure they've got an airtight case before they take it to the jury, the grand jury.
Exactly. You can't hope that you have a lot of circumstantial evidence. That is not going to cut it.
We still do have the outstanding case with the Ke Aloha payout, the so-called settlement, and that's been kicked off now till next year.
Right. And that may have some impact because there is, I believe, a dishonest services charge, which is the statute that we're talking about, as part of that. So that may have an impact on how that goes. You know, one of the foundations of the Supreme Court's majority opinion, and remember, this was a 6-3 decision where once again, the 6 conservative members of the court sided together and the 3 liberal members of the court dissented. The majority's focus was, again, states' rights. Look, we're here in the federal government. We don't want to tell the state how to run their local politicians, and therefore we're going to let the state take care of these rules and these, you know, they can have rules against taking gratuities, they can have criminal statutes against taking gratuities, but we're going to leave that up to all the states to do it because every state's different. The practices, the business practices of every state is different. So why should we as the federal government have a uniform rule that dictates to all the states how this should be interpreted? We're going to let the states do it. So what that really means is now 100% falls upon the legislature to adopt rules or to attack criminal statutes that address this issue. And so far, as we know from campaign finance reform legislation, that the legislature has been 100% against adopting strict rules against these kinds of gratuities. You know, we know about that New York Times civil court article talking about these parties that were had in back rooms. And, you know, that is not criminal under state law. And that will remain not being criminal and remain being acceptable practices so long as our legislature now, because that's the only people who can do it, doesn't enact some kind of meaningful reform in terms of campaign funding and campaign contribution.
Right. So unless the community steps up and presses them to pass tougher laws, I mean, I don't know what else can be done, or is there anything with the Ethics Commission that we could tighten up there as well?
Well, absolutely. The Campaign Spending Commission, the Ethics Commission, they have the power to make rules about, you know, gratuities and campaign contributions. They can make these rules that you can be in violation of in addition to the legislature. So now, based upon this ruling, it's totally up to our local government and state government to make these rules and these statutes and enforce them. Remember, nothing is good unless you enforce it. And if you don't enforce it, then, you know, you may have all the good laws on the books that you want. It doesn't mean anything. You know, one of the interesting things that we need to look at coming forward is what came out of the Kaneshiro-Mitsunaga trial was this clear testimony that there were clearly illegal campaign contributions being given, either under the current state laws, by Ms. Ohtani, allegedly. And two of those campaign contributions that were given, that was testified to, still fall within the statute of limitations that can be prosecuted. So those, it's going to be interesting to see moving forward whether either the prosecutor's office or the AG's office actually bring those charges. because they've been testified to under oath that this occurred. They can be charged. They can either charge it as a crime or just collect, you know, the refund, the money. But it's there, and it's going to be really interesting to see what happens, because if nothing happens, it's a clear sign that this is going to be allowed, and no one under the state and local government cares anymore. And that's a signal to everybody. So that's something we got to look out for and just see how that moves forward, because it's right there in the open, and it's going to tell you a lot about the direction Hawaii is going to go.
Right. And so you're looking for some outrage out there.
Well, I mean, there should be outrage, and there should be pressure for something to be done, or at least explain, if nothing is done, you know, what course of action and why it was done.
Why or why not?
Exactly. So it's out there. At least this one little kernel is out there, and we'll see what happens.
That was Ali Silbert, retired federal public defender, talking about a recent high court bribery ruling that he says puts more pressure on local governments to pass and enforce tougher public corruption laws. Silbert previously represented Gerald Puana, whose case led to the conviction of Honolulu's former police chief and his wife, a deputy city prosecutor.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Dowling Family Charitable Fund, Dowling Company, for more than three decades working to develop housing projects for the Maui community and committed to building in balance, an HPR supporter since 2001.
HPR has won a first place award from the Public Media Journalists Association for our podcast, This Is Our Hawaii.
A new podcast about the legacy of large land ownership and what it really means to belong in Hawaii today. Oko makou Hawaii keia.
Subscribe to This Is Our Hawaii at hawaiipublicradio.org/ourhawaii.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Museum of Art, with HOMA Nights, open until 9 p.m. Fridays for art experiences, stargazing in the courtyards, music, dinner, and drinks. HonoluluMuseum.org.
Areas prone to wildfires are now under a new program as of this month. Hawaiian Electric Company calls it the Public Safety Power Shutoff Program. HECO just began holding meetings in affected areas. HPR reporter Savannah Harriman-Pote is tracking those meetings. Good morning, Savannah.
Hi, good morning, Catherine. Thanks for having me on.
Yes, so you were monitoring the meeting out on the west side of Oahu, and there's another meeting tonight, right?
That's correct. So backing up a little bit, this public safety shutoff program was announced by Hawaiian Electric on May 30th, so the end of May. And since then, they've been trying to do community outreach in affected areas. There's about 47,000 people across Hawaii Island, Maui, Tawny, and Oahu who may be impacted. And they have been doing meetings on Hawaii Island and Maui County. But this meeting last Thursday in Waianae was the first meeting for West Side residents of Oahu to understand what the impact would be to them of this public safety power shutoff and take their questions directly to Hawaiian Electric. And I talked to one person, Linda Jury, who is a lifelong resident of Waianae, and she found out that she was going to be potentially impacted by one of these fire prevention shutoffs because she got a letter in the mail notifying her that the public safety shutoff program was launching within a week. And so she and many of her neighbors showed up to the public meeting held by HECO last Thursday to try to understand what they needed to do to prepare.
There was some people who were upset, and rightfully so. You know, they have to plan, and this meeting is happening 1 week before the protocol gets put in place. So I can see and understand why people would be frustrated initially, when I first saw the letter, I just wanted to learn more about it. It did say July 1st they were going to start putting that into place. I knew that they weren't just going to shut the power off. I know that there are certain circumstances and they have their criteria that they have to use. So I wasn't like totally alarmed, but I did want to know more information about it.
So what kinds of questions, did the community have?
Well, one of the big questions that communities want to know is how often could this happen? The utility has said that when conditions similar to red flag conditions, so low humidity, high winds, dry conditions kick into place, they might preemptively shut off the power. And it's important for people to know that when they shut off the power, it could be off for a couple of hours or a couple of days. So it's really important to have advance notice and have preparations in place. Unfortunately, HECO can't predict the future. It is establishing more weather stations, but they said that these conditions could appear in the summer months anywhere from multiple times to not at all. So folks just need to be kind of ready to go as we get into fire season and really understand that this could impact them.
And so there are other meetings scheduled?
Yeah, so there will be additional meetings where people can bring their questions on Oahu. So we have the Waianae Neighborhood Board meeting tonight. And then again, there's a meeting next Monday in Nanikuli for folks on the west side who have questions about how long will the power be out, what will happen to medical facilities, what should they do if they're medically vulnerable. There'll be some meetings for West Maui residents who are going to be impacted Saturday, July 13th, and then additional meetings in Hawaii County towards the end of the month. And what Linda really wanted to know when she went to the meeting last Thursday was what resources there might be available for families who are going to have to deal with the economic burden of a power shutoff. So she lives in a household of eight, including her kids and her mom, and she says that her weekly grocery budget is about $500. And she thinks she's lucky because she has a generator, right? So she knows her family will be able to ride up these power outages. But backup power is not something that everyone has access to. And if they get caught off guard by one of these power outages, will they be able to afford being able to replace a week's worth of groceries? Here's Linda.
Probably in our community, that is the biggest concern. We are accustomed to the heat out here. We can deal with that, but dealing with having to replace $500 of groceries in your icebox, that is something that is detrimental to the family. As we know, some people are just one paycheck away from being homeless out here. We got lots of people on the beach already. And so that's a big concern. And not to mention, of course, there was a lot of people who were concerned about having kupuna, having the disabled in their homes, and they need the power for medical situations. That's a whole nother challenge in itself.
And HECO is already trying to take stock of, who might be dependent on power for their medical devices.
So they are asking their customers to specifically register with them if they have, for instance, if they're on dialysis or if they have a ventilator, or even some people's hearing aids require electricity in order to continue to work. When I spoke to a spokesperson last Friday, they said so far they have about 480 people who have signed up. Those folks would receive additional medical alerts. So HECO will try to give them even more notice. But in terms of programs to specifically assist those folks, right now HECO is saying that needs to occur on the individual level. You need to be in contact with your provider about where you can go in terms of if the power gets shut off and you need electricity. They did note that under the public safety shutoff program areas, there's no major hospitals or clinics that are going to lose power. So all of those facilities will stay online. And many of those facilities, if not all of them, also have backup power in place to continue operating during an outage.
And then just some of those areas. I mean, here on Oahu, then it's what, the west side? Is it central Oahu? Where exactly on the Big Island, that kind of thing?
Yeah, so it's primarily West Oahu, Waianae, along that coastline. And then on Maui, we have upcountry Maui, as well as Lahaina and the surrounding area, West Maui. There are a couple of areas that are affected on Molokai, though far fewer individual residents. And then the largest number of people impacted is actually on Big Island. And you got the Kona community affected, you got Waikoloa affected, and the Kohala area as well. And if you go to Hawaiian Electric, you'll see maps that they've made in order to try to give people a sense of what communities could be impacted by a shutoff. And I'll tell you, they're a little hard to parse, you know, that they're kind of big blocky areas that are colored in that show you what the shutoff range is. But Hawaiian Electric just launched a new feature that I really encourage people to check out. And we'll have this available and linked on our website where you can type in your address and then it'll show you on the map if your specific address is impacted. So I'm actually in Kona right now. I'm staying with my folks here. And they were not people who received any notification in the mail or via email because they don't pay for the electricity bill in their multifamily home, multifamily unit. So we last night typed in their address, and sure enough, they are in this PSPS range. So that's just one of those, you know, blind spots that might occur in the system. If you have not registered with Hawaiian Electric or you are not the person who pays the bills for electricity in your household, you might not get direct communications from Hawaiian Electric, and you need to make sure that you're monitoring social media, Hawaiian Electric's channels, as well as media communications that they put out ahead of a shutoff event.
Right. Yeah, but I think it's just the reality of the situation now that people just need to be just more resilient and ready for anything.
Certainly, and I think in order for people to be resilient, they have to have noticed that this is going to happen. So HECO has said, we will try to give you 48 hours notice, 24 hours notice, as much as we can. But since this is weather dependent, it all depends on how the winds shift. So that's why they're encouraging people, you know, July 1st is the launch date. We're not saying that we're going to have one of these shutoff events, but starting this week, we want folks to be prepared in case they happen.
Right. It's in place now. But thanks so much, Savannah.
Thank you, Catherine.
That was HVR Savannah Harriman-Pote talking to us about Hawaiian Electric's Public Safety Power Shutoff Program. There is a meeting tonight at the Waianae District Park Multipurpose Room starting at 6:30 p.m. We'll also have a link to more information on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Mobi, a Hawaii wireless company since 2005, featuring a locally based customer care team committed to problem solving and personal service for each client. Learn more at mobi.com.
Each week, New Dimensions explores the social, political, scientific, environmental, and spiritual frontiers with some of today's foremost social innovators, thinkers, scientists, and creative artists.
Hi, I'm Rick Hansen, author of the new book, Neurodharma. Next time on New Dimensions, I'll be talking about new science, ancient wisdom, and seven practices of the highest happiness.
Beginning Sunday morning at 11.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaii Gas, celebrating 120 years in Hawaii with stories from its people and community. More about the 120 Stories Project at hawaiigas.com/history.
Hawaii farmers grow hundreds of thousands of pounds of avocados every year, putting the state's production at third in the country, behind Florida and California. More than 200 varieties are grown here in the islands, but the cash crop and a majority of those exported belong to the Charwell variety. Part of the reason is a fruit fly scare that began in the 1990s that led the U.S. Department of Agriculture to decide that it would only allow that variety to be exported to the continent without a mandatory quarantine. But how do you tell two avocados apart? That question was dogging Pei Liang. She's a research agricultural engineer at the USDA Agricultural Research Station in Hilo. She recently led a new study to tell Charwell avocados apart using a handheld device that many growers already have. She spoke with The Conversation's Maddie Bender about her research.
with avocado. We have over 200 varieties in Hawaii. But at the point of writing of this, doing this research, Charlotte was the only variety that can be exported without quarantine treatments. The reason why it is like the first variety that we push to export is because it also has great quality. So Charlotte does have a great reputation for being delicious avocado. The few incidents that I am aware of is that people would be selling their avocados, saying that they are Charwell because it's prized variety of avocados, when they either didn't know what they're growing or they just decided to put a name on it. You know, that's kind of how this whole research started, to look at if there's an easier way to tell different varieties of avocados apart, or simply tell the ones that they are clear for export apart from the others.
Yeah, because right now the way that people tell them apart is they're looking at them. But
yeah,
is that not always the best way to tell two varieties of avocados apart from one another?
I think for the very experienced growers, they know, they can tell. I can't. I can tell. I see big avocado and small avocado and different color, different shades, and some have bumpy skin, some are shiny. But again, there are 200 varieties. I can't tell them apart.
And then, of course, you can't very well take a sample out of an avocado to sequence it or run a test on it, because that ruins the avocado. Then you can't sell that one.
Correct.
This is where spectroscopy comes in. So give us the lowdown on what this technique actually is and what it's typically used for.
Spectroscopy in general is to use light to tell something about your samples. So generally, like, these, a spectrometer has a light source and then shine on your sample, whatever sample that is. And then based on the light that either goes through your samples or bounce back from your sample, then you can tell what you're looking at. That sounds kind of silly. But with the near-infrared spectroscopy, it's specifically to look at biochemical composition of your samples. So near-infrared is outside of visible light. So it's not a light that we can see with our eyes. It's just beyond red. And this region of light specifically interact with different chemical compounds in your samples. So near-infrared spectroscopy is pretty established equipment. Like, it's a lot of applications are in food quality control. It has been used in avocados as well. Another common use of near-infrared spectroscopy is in maturity. So for people like me, I don't have the experience to say, oh, this avocado is ready to be harvested, or this avocado is immature. So that is a way of near-infrared that's already been used in avocados, is to evaluate its maturity status.
So is what you're trying to do here then use this established technique to distinguish between different varieties?
Yeah. So with our experiments, we actually started in 2022. And back then, we used a benchtop system. So these are a little bigger and more expensive and more elaborate equipment, mostly used indoor in the lab. And then we have three or four different varieties in 2022. And then we look at if we can, it's more like a feasibility study. We want to see if it has the potential to work, right? And then it seemed promising back then. We were able to get pretty good results telling different varieties apart. So in 2023, then we collect some more samples, but this time we use a handheld spectrometer. So these spectrometers are made to be more rugged, and then it's made to be used in the field. So people can carry it places to places. It was a battery, and it's really just a box in your hand that you can, like, just emit your samples and collect the spectra, and it's supposed to tell you which variety it is. So yeah, it was the 2023, the results was our handheld spectrometer. These handheld spectrometers, because they're handheld, they're more limited, so like the range of light is smaller and the resolution was not as great as a benchtop system. But even with a handheld spectrometer, we still have over 95% accuracy in telling Sharwell apart from three or four other varieties that we included. So we were able to get pretty good results in like picking out which one is Sharwell and which ones are not.
Would this be something that regulatory agencies would use, or the growers themselves, or where would this factor into the process?
Where this will go is first will be the packing house. That's the main collaborators that we've been working with. If there's any disagreement on what kind of avocados they're looking at, there's a backup for them to at least know the type of avocados that they're looking at, right? Mm-hmm. And ultimately, like, this would be more like a screening method, because like to know it for sure, which variety that you're looking at, it will be genetic method. But we can't really go scrape the skin of every single avocados that we're not sure about to know what they are, because then we know what they are and we can't sell them. We are also in contact with APHIS, so that's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service, is also part of USDA. They would be the regulatory people to potentially use this technology. Another thing that I have heard people mention is like for new growers, so for growers that who are growing avocados but not experienced enough to tell these varieties apart, this would be a good like a training tool for them to be able to like, oh, I think this is so and so, but like let me check and see how close we are, or if I was right, wrong, and you know, what should I be looking at. So I think those would be like the places where this technology can be used and be helpful.
Yeah. I know you said earlier, for instance, that like just by looking at an avocado, you can't necessarily tell varieties apart. It doesn't seem like you have like a great deal of experience growing, spending time with avocados. So what was it about this research topic that interested you? Why did you get involved and conduct the study?
The first author on this publication was a student from UH. She was in a program called Pacific Internship Program for Exploring Science. And then she was the summer intern with us. One of the other scientists came to me and she's like, so I heard that you're using this technology. Can it be used for telling different avocado varieties apart? That's kind of where it all started. And I was like, yeah, maybe. Let's try it.
Oh, and now I'm looking at the paper and she has an author credit. So that is awesome.
No, yeah, I am very proud of her. But yeah, no, she did a ton of work, and I think the first authorship was well deserved.
That's a great story behind the study. I'm glad I asked.
Yeah, I'm glad you asked.
That was USDA researcher Pei Liang talking with HPR's Maddie Bender. That study was published in the journal Public Library of Science 1. Liang says current spectroscopy methods used by avocado growers to determine the maturity of their produce is meant for Haas avocados, and she is working on adapting the technology to be used more accurately on the Sharwell variety.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Board of Water Supply, committed to the conservation and protection of water resources for Oahu. Learn more about how to reduce water waste at boardofwatersupply.com.
This week's performance at HPR's Hawaii Jazz Performance Series is sold out. Mahalo for your support. Watch videos from past HPR concerts and sign up for email alerts for future performances. Visit hawaiipublicradio.org, sponsored by Farm Lovers Markets.
Olha, que profunda é a água, Support for HPR comes from Hawaiian Airlines, connecting Hawaii with international destinations, including Japan, Australia, New Zealand, and South Korea. Schedules and reservations at hawaiianairlines.com/globetrotter.
Dorinda Nicholson was 6 years old and living on the Pearl City Peninsula when Japanese bombers attacked Pearl Harbor. She still has vivid memories. The octogenarian was back in Honolulu recently to help open a new exhibit at the USS Battleship Missouri Memorial entitled Life After Infamy, The Resilience of the Aloha Spirit in Wartime Hawaii. She's authored a couple of books about growing up in wartime Hawaii and is also the inspiration behind the American girl doll Nanea. The conversations Lillian Song sat down with Nicholson, who encourages others to share their story.
I've been telling the story for a long time, and I want the listeners to know how important it is to write your own family history. You don't have to be an eyewitness to a 9/11 or any major event. You are an eyewitness to where your family came from. The exhibit on the USS Missouri will be up for about a year, and it features the work that Red Cross did during that time. And the part that is the most touching to me, in fact, I cried when I looked at that panel, was Hula won the war, according to me. My mother was a Kumu in the Pearl City area, and now we're talking the 40s, 50s, 60s. My heritage is Hawaiian and Haole. I love the stories my mother tells me, who was born in 1896, when Hawaii was still a monarchy. And Hawaiian being her first language, being punished for speaking Hawaiian. So my generation grows up not learning our language. Nobody's teaching it because we're going to be so American. And I started telling my story at the 25th anniversary of the beginning of the war, where I now live in the Kansas City area. And, you know, I thought 25th anniversary. So I contacted the newspaper and said, I have a story. And they said, please write it. So I asked mom and dad, you know, what do you remember? Send me pictures. And I wrote the story, and it got published in the big Sunday edition. And I folded up the newspaper, put it away in the drawer, and really another 25 years goes by. And it's now 1991, and the papers are saying, huge anniversary, the 50th of the beginning of the war. Mm. And so I called Honolulu and I said, I understand you have this commemoration event. Who are your speakers? And they said it was Admiral so-and-so and Captain such-and-such and historian and biographer. And I said, do you have any natives speaking? Oh, no. And I said, well, do you have any women speaking? No. Do you have any children of the war? They said children weren't involved. And I said, I want to tell you my story. And the Arizona Memorial, the committee or the group that was in charge of the memorial events asked me to write my story, and they first published it. And then National Geographic saw my book, and I was so pleased because World War II had been documented, but nobody told the children's stories. When my story was published, servicemen, Pearl Harbor survivors, my Japanese neighbors, people started bringing me their stories. What a makana, what a gift. And so I added those stories to the back of mine and found out there's so many stories. One of the men, he's on the West Virginia battleship, the bugler, so he's up on the bridge getting ready to blow, you know, so the men know to get up and in position to raise the flag at 8 o'clock. And out of the corner of his eye, he sees this low-flying airplane. And his first response is, how dare that American plane come in here like that? And it's Sunday morning. I'm going to get the number off the tail of his airplane. I'll have him court-martialed. And then out of the belly of the plane are the torpedoes. They take 6 of them. His ship is sunk. He only survives when Captain Benyon actually tells the men, abandon ship, and he swims to Fort Island. I treasure those stories, but that illustrates the sheer shock and surprise. It can't happen. And my dad and I run out in the yard. We look up and it's early. It's, you know, it's just a little before 8 in the morning. And because of where we live, right by the water, the planes are coming in so low and the canopy opened up. And when the pilots are looking, you can see the goggles on their eyes.
You were that close?
You were that close. Just barely above our housetop and our rooftop.
Mm.
I'd love to know what my 25-year-old father was thinking. He grabbed me, went in the house, got baby brother out of the crib, mom, put us in the back seat, and we drove up Lehua Avenue, cross Kamehameha Highway, and go straight up. The Waimano home was located up there, and then just sugarcane fields, and that's where we hid. Pretty soon, more and more and more of our neighbors were coming. That's when we started listening to the car radio. Webley Edwards was an old-time radio broadcaster, and he came on the air saying, stay in your house. This is the real McCoy. This is not a drill.
The memories you have, what happened to your family to evacuate, of hearing what was coming over the radio, these are all parts of wartime. Going back to this exhibit, though, why is it important to continue sharing your story? What would you like to underscore about life after infamy?
Here in Hawaii and at the USS Missouri, we are telling our story. I believe my exhibit is important. We are the ground zero of the beginning of the war and the resiliency, again, of the Aloha spirit. Hawaii changed so much, so quickly. The military had to send their families away. So you have this exodus, less people to watch, guard, feed. And so you're going to fill ships, send all the women and children away, and put these young men who signed up to come to Hawaii shores. The military is everywhere, but you bring them home with you. And you thank them for their service. You see them hitchhiking. You pick them up. The men in the harbor, in fact, we imported workers to work in the shipyards. The West Virginia that I mentioned to you that sunk. I loved that it was raised because Pearl Harbor's shallow. So we didn't lose it in the deep ocean. We raised it, fixed it. And it attended the USS Missouri ceremony, September 2nd, Tokyo Bay, 1945. It was there, the beginning of the war and at the end of the war. And just one of the many stories of living through that time. The men, so such a time of coming together, and we felt such a love for our country and for the flag, and what can I do? So when I visit today and I talk to schools and kids, and in fact, there's an American Girl doll that is my story.
Mm-hmm.
And I love the way the message ends with her, in that Nanea asks, what can you do now? You know, does your tutu man need you to take out the garbage? Do you need to go pick up trash in your neighborhood? Does your teacher need help? What can you do to help with the Aloha spirit on your own? And no wait for an anniversary. Write today your history, your story. Your family needs your story.
That was author and Pearl City native Dorinda Nicholson talking with HBR's Lillian Song. Nicholson has published several books about her childhood wartime memories and has been featured in National Geographic. Her story is the basis for the exhibit Life After Infamy, currently on display at the USS Battleship Missouri Memorial. She has lent various wartime artifacts to the exhibit, including her gas mask and bullets that her dad dug out of the kitchen walls. The exhibit will be on display through June 2025, just prior to the 80th anniversary of the ending of World War II. Well, that wraps it up for us today. Tomorrow, we plan to hear more about a Supreme Court ruling on homelessness. What are the impacts here in Hawaii? We do welcome feedback. Call our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can also find the conversation as a podcast on Google, Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.